You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up for the next 2 weeks, WPR is exploring Wisconsin's complicated relationship with alcohol. We'll get a preview with the executive producer of the project. First, you might remember the educational computer game, The Oregon Trail, where your biggest concerns as 19th century pioneers were broken wagon axles, how many pounds of buffalo you can carry, or avoiding dysentery. There's a new game out that follows a similar adventure-style format, but this one includes stories told from the perspective of Native Americans displaced by colonization. It's called When Rivers Were Trails. Elizabeth Liponce is the lead creator of the game. She's a designer, writer, artist, and researcher who creates and studies indigenous-led media like games and comics. She's an assistant professor of media and information at Michigan State University. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us today.
Miigwech, thank you for having me.
Well, talk to us about why this was a game that you wanted to create.
Well, the Indian Land Tenure Foundation had already developed the Lessons of Our Land curriculum, and the creative director of When Rivers Were Trails, Nicholas Emmons, had approached me about making a game that could extend from their curriculum and reach students through classrooms. So I was very inspired with a combination of that, as well as someone who grew up with the game Oregon Trail. I've always been really interested in creating an indigenous take on Oregon Trail that would make up for all the times that I had in classroom experiences playing a game that really perceived Native people to be there on behalf of settlers. They're always guides or they're there to trade with. And I was really interested in seeing a game that actually showed Native people for themselves for what was happening during colonization.
And when people think of Native Americans being relocated, they might think of the Trail of Tears further south. Your story, your game shows that there is a very comparable story going on for decades here in the Midwest, right?
Absolutely. Really, due to the process of allotment, which was the separation of land into parcels, which was then given to settlers very often with the premise that some would be given to Native people. But in reality, there were a lot of missteps that happened with treaties, a lot of taking advantage of nations. Instead, then it acted as a form of displacement and created many paths of movement for people all across the way.
So when we sit down to play When Rivers Were Trails, give us the starting point. Where are we starting off?
You start off as an Anishinaabe person in Fond du Lac, and you're effectively run off by gunpoint. This is a true story from Vern Northrup that comes from his family. And so this was a common practice where maybe you didn't actually intend to give up your land, but it was given up on your behalf. And in his case, in his family, a relative of his returned home to find that his land had been given to settlers who thought that it was their territory. And so he was run off. And so you are this person, although you are genderless and you never get to see yourself, you're really put in the position of seeing what it would be like to be displaced. And you continue on a journey all the way from Minnesota to California.
And as I understand it, in theory, there's land waiting for you in California. But as the game goes on, that keeps getting whittled down, as it probably was in history.
Absolutely. And effectively, you're someone who was sent to White Earth because that was a common practice at the time that was done, the forced movement. And you are given opportunities to help with resistances along the way. So historically, Red Lake, for example, was able to hold a lot more land because they banded together and they tried to take their allotment side by side, which was really against what the practice of allotment was trying to do. They were trying to divide up the land to weaken communities. And so you go all along the way looking for work or trading, coming across other communities, and all of the stories are written by Indigenous people who represent or have connections to elders, storytellers, language speakers of those nations. And there are over 20 Indigenous writers represented through the game.
That's what struck me, this great collaboration in building this tapestry of stories in the game. Can you talk more about how you did that?
Absolutely. So the art is done by Washoya Alvitre, who is Tongva, and then I did the user interface art, and the textures were a collaboration. And so it fuses our styles, while then she was inspired by the written descriptions of over 20 Indigenous writers, all of whom come from all the way across the land that you journey along. And effectively, all of the writers sent us content, and then the student team at Michigan State University, a part of the Games for Entertainment and Learning Lab, did a lot of work to help writers who had not necessarily all written for games, in fact, the majority of them had not, to adapt that writing into what would work within a game. And so it was a long iterative process.
We're talking to Elizabeth LaPonce about her new game, a collaboration, as we just heard. It's called When Rivers Were Trails. Talk about that title, if you would, Elizabeth. What's the meaning of that?
There was a time in which rivers were seen as trails. So when we thought about the waterways, we thought about travel, we thought about trade points. And during the 1890s, all of the maps started to reflect instead railroads and this new movement of seeing transportation as oriented around trains and being able to move many people as well as many supplies and in turn many settlers. And so really what the game title is about is bringing us back to remembering a time when rivers were our trails.
Looking at this as part of a history curriculum we might have, I'll say in my experience learning history in school, when you heard stories about journeys in the United States or the pre-United States, it was a military expedition, an explorer, a settler, a pioneer. It was Europeans journeying across America. This, for a lot of students, these journeys of Native Americans forced at the beginning, they were invisible to us in a lot of ways. Can you talk about your hope to bring those stories back to everybody's eye?
Absolutely. Really, the inspiration for this is going back to Nicholas Emmons and the Lessons of Our Land curriculum from the Indian Land Tenure Foundation, and they already have that curriculum distributed to schools, which is a really brilliant way in which a game can then also become a part of curriculum actively within public schools, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity for that to be happening. So really, in a sense, because of the basis of this existing curriculum, the game is a way to experience what it would be like to endure through allotment, through colonization, to understand that Native people were not stagnant, right? There were a lot of trade systems. There was a lot of traveling happening, that it was not that only happened when colonizers came in.
Who do you envision playing your game as it gets released into the public and to schools?
Ideally, the audience is middle school and high school students. So far, the game has been played in classrooms of a wide range of ages, and it has also reached outside. And in fact, a Game Informer gave it a review that it's an educational game that is also entertaining, that it blurs the line between education and entertainment. And so what I have learned from this is that the game is playable, not just within an educational or curriculum context, but as a game in and of itself by all people.
Having gone through the experience of making When Rivers Were Trails, do you have another project in mind now?
Oh, yeah, I'm taking a break from large scale managing over 20, you know, a team of over 20 mm-hmm. writers, multiple students working on the team as well, who were all doing their best while also balancing being students, right? So it's a really massive project. There are 12 maps, effectively 12 levels in the game, and so there's about 3 hours of gameplay or more, depending on how long you take to read through the scenarios, how long you sit with them. And so right now I'm working on Along the River of Space Time, which is a virtual reality game in which you activate Anishinaabe constellations to then heal the waters of 360 real film environments that are around you. And that is a gallery experience that will be minutes of gameplay, so vastly different. And so it's really great that in the work that I do, I can bounce back and forth between different modes of gameplay.
We'll leave it there for now. Elizabeth, thanks so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you, Miigwech, for having me.
Elizabeth LaPonce is a designer, writer, artist, and researcher who creates and studies indigenous-led media like games and comics. She's an assistant professor of media and information at Michigan State University. We talked to her about a new educational video game she created from the Native American perspective called When Rivers Were Trails. Coming up, we'll talk to WPR's news director about a new series looking at Wisconsin's complicated relationship with alcohol. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report from the CDC finds more than 1 million people lost health insurance coverage in 2018. We'll learn more about what led to that drop and the role healthcare politics could play in the 2020 election. First, alcohol is a big part of Wisconsin's culture, from the state's early history in the beer brewing industry to its lonely claim to being the only state that doesn't make a first OWI offense a crime. All this week and next week, WPR is taking a closer look at the state's relationship with alcohol in a new series called High Tolerance. Noah Ovshinsky is WPR's news director and the executive producer of that series. Noah, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here, Rob. Thanks.
This is a big topic, as I see from the range of features you all are doing. What led you to want to explore this complicated relationship with alcohol?
Yeah, Rob, you know, in journalism, we're always interested in outliers. You know, there are a lot of stories usually to be told when we talk about outliers. And Wisconsin is an outlier in many, many ways when it comes to alcohol. And we felt like this was an opportunity for us to add to the body of reporting that already exists out there about alcohol and tell what we think is a very nuanced, fair story over the course of the next 2 weeks about the role, good and bad, that alcohol plays in the state.
Talk about a few ways that you see Wisconsin being, and not just you, that Wisconsin is an outlier when it comes to alcohol.
Well, I mean, you just mentioned a big one and a quite controversial one, which is Wisconsin is the only state where first-time OWI or first-time drunk driving is not a criminal offense. In the eyes of the courts, it's basically a traffic ticket. I mean, that's pretty unusual. It makes Wisconsin very unique. If you look at national data, we also drink more than most any other state. We also have more bars than many other states. And if you talk to people who move here from out of state, it's common for people to say, gosh, you know, Wisconsin is unique when it comes to its alcohol culture and the role that it plays not only in our economy, but in daily life.
So give us an idea of at least some of the kinds of stories we're going to hear over the next couple of weeks about Wisconsin and alcohol.
Right. So we'll be talking a lot about the role that alcohol plays at the state capitol, how the alcohol gets to the manufacturer, to our doorstep, and how that journey is influenced by the politics of the state capitol. We'll be discussing how alcohol is, socially is such a big deal in Wisconsin, how it is an economic development driver in many parts of Wisconsin, especially rural areas that have seen a renaissance because of microbreweries and wineries and businesses like that popping up in areas that need those kinds of businesses.
And it isn't all the bad stuff about alcohol. It isn't all the damage. You're not shying away from that either.
Right, and
that's part of the complicated side of things. One of the things is a tap handle manufacturers here in the state.
Yeah. I mean, there are people whose job it is to make tap handles. I mean, they're artists. They own as much of this story as anybody else does. It's very nuanced and it's not black and white. We don't shy away from, you know, the devastating loss that can come from alcohol in the state. But at the same time, we balance that against the role that it plays in our celebrations, the role that it plays in our economy. But it is for sure a very complicated story.
We're talking to Noah Ovshinsky, WPR news director, executive producer of the new news series on the state's relationship with alcohol. It's called High Tolerance. And I want to take a listen now to the first story in that series. Wisconsin Public Radio's Laurel White starts us off looking at why drinking plays an outsized role in many people's image of the state.
The sun is just starting to come up on Sunday morning. It's just before 6 a.m., about 40 degrees, and people are swaddled in sleeping bags in a brewery parking lot. Greg Francik is awake, sitting in a lawn chair.
But yeah, right now I think pretty much mostly everyone's sleeping. There's still a few people up that, like, you know, just up all night.
You can see air mattresses poking out of a few tents people have brought. Some people have also brought grills to the parking lot and are starting to make breakfast. Nick Courtney is one of them.
It's a thing to do. You show up, you have some fun, you drink some beers, you grill some meat.
The vibe is like camping meets music festival meets doorbuster line on Black Friday. So why are these people here?
You get something beer related at the end?
There's a huge beer selection.
Good beer.
Being able to try different beers.
To share beers.
Really good beers.
Beer.
All the people in this line are here for just one thing. They're all waiting in line to buy tickets to a craft beer festival called Great Taste of the Midwest. The tickets go on sale in 6 hours. This is Wisconsin, and people are passionate about their beer. In fact, eating and drinking outside is Wisconsinites' second favorite recreational outdoor activity. A survey out this month from the State Department of Natural Resources ranked it just behind walking and running. Julia Sherman is the coordinator of the Alcohol Policy Project at the UW-Madison. She says alcohol is associated with things like summertime, sports, and college campuses just about everywhere. But she says Wisconsin is different.
I think that a lot of it comes from the fact that it's not specific occasions, it's almost every occasion.
The Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project estimates, based on federal statistics, the average Wisconsinite has 634 drinks each year. That's nearly 150 more than the national average. Jim Drager was a historic preservation officer for the state and is the author of Bottoms Up, a book that explores the history of bars and brewing in Wisconsin. He says there's a cultural consensus that Wisconsin is a place that imbibes freely and frequently.
People are told to think of Wisconsin that way because people constantly talk about it that way.
Drager says media plays a big part in perpetuating the stereotype of Wisconsin as a boozy state. That includes comedians like Lewis Black.
I love Wisconsin. I love coming here. I perform here a lot because I've discovered that you people apparently have some sort of federal grant for drinking.
Drager says Wisconsinites play into this sort of message.
People are more outwardly social about alcohol in Wisconsin than they are in other places.
Drager says examples of that include things like craft beer festivals or just drinking at bars. He says Wisconsin has, historically and today, more bars than the vast majority of other states. Julia Sherman agrees availability of alcohol plays a big role in shaping Wisconsin's identity.
We're, to my knowledge, the only state where you can have an alcohol, a beer, wine, and distilled spirits tasting at a gas station.
Sometimes Wisconsinites poke fun at their own image as social drinkers. Sherman calls it a perverse pride.
But attitudes can change, and attitudes are going to have to change here in Wisconsin.
Sherman says the cultural association Wisconsinites sometimes embrace has a dark side and a high cost. Healthcare costs, law enforcement costs, and human costs when lives are lost. She says to avoid racking up more of those costs, Wisconsin communities need to embrace other parts of the state's identity. So she issues this gentle reminder. Wisconsin has a lot more to offer than just a cold beer. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Noah, Laurel was talking about some of those costs, and that is part of what the rest of the series is going to be covering over the next couple of weeks. Can you talk about some of the features that will be focused in on those costs?
Yeah, so we'll be digging in more into the cost that alcohol has on families and the issue of kids being taken away from families because of a chemical dependency with alcohol. We'll be talking about the availability of treatment or the lack thereof in vast stretches of the state that don't have the treatment facilities that, say, Madison or Milwaukee might. What options are available to them? What is the cost with the health care costs associated with it? What is the cost in human life, as Laurel indicated in her story with that interview? We'll be talking about the devastation, the emotional devastation that can come about from, a drunk driving incident.
And I'm looking forward to not just this series, Noah, but after. I mean, you all in the news department are going to have this huge institutional body of knowledge for our future coverage of alcohol-related issues in the state.
Absolutely. We've been working on this series for months. In fact, the idea was first hatched, I guess, last December or so. So we've been working on it quite a while. A lot of great reporting has gone into it. And I would just encourage people to tune in for the next 2 weeks, listen to these stories, go to the website, read these stories. Of course, some of the best stuff, landed on the cutting room floor. And so we, for the radio, we had to fit all of these things in about 3.5 minutes. So we encourage people to visit the website and look at the entire project, not just what happens on the radio, but also these stories that we have online, as well as some graphics and photos.
Right. One of those graphics that struck me, and a simpler version of this went viral a while back, was comparing taverns against grocery stores or liquor stores against grocery stores. I can't remember, but whichever it was, Wisconsin being the only state with more of the alcohol establishments than grocery stores. The only one in the country.
Like we say in journalism, outliers usually make good stories. And in this case, the state certainly is.
Okay, give us a preview of the next few features that are going to be coming up early in the week. And
yeah.
This is going to be, you'll hear these, by the way, here on the Ideas Network on the morning show and here on Central Time throughout the next couple of weeks.
WPR.org/alcohol would be mm-hmm. the website home. So for the next few days, we'll be talking about Sean Johnson has been looking deeply at sort of how we got here politically, how our current system of alcohol manufacture and distribution coming out of Prohibition, how it was formed, and how it's changed over the years and how very complicated it is. So complicated, in fact, that there are very few people in the state that actually understand it in its totality. So Sean Johnson will be digging into that.
All right. Noah, thanks so much for joining us today. We'll look forward to the series.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's WPR News Director Noah Ovshinsky with us today to talk about WPR's series kicking off today. It takes a closer look at Wisconsin's complicated relationship with alcohol. As you heard, we'll be bringing you stories and interviews on different aspects of the issue on the morning show and Central Time this week and next week. And you can find more, as Noah was saying, online at WPR.org/alcohol. Coming up, a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention finds that more than 1 million people lost health insurance coverage in 2018. We'll find out why that is and how the healthcare conversation could be a big part of the 2020 presidential race. You can share your thoughts. What do you want to see at the federal government level when it comes to healthcare? Do you want the Affordable Care Act to continue, to go away? Do you want Medicare for all? And what do you want to hear candidates talking about in the races for president and Congress? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, John Munson is in for Kate Archer Kent. John's guest tells us what happens when words fail us. John talks to the author of the new book, Unspeakable, The Things We Cannot Say. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, roughly 1.1 million Americans lost health insurance coverage between 2017 and 2018. That's according to a recent survey conducted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The survey found this is the second year in a row where the country has seen a sizable increase in the number of uninsured citizens. While there are a number of factors at play, one big potential influence is the repeal of the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate by congressional Republicans in 2017. That rule required all Americans to purchase insurance or have coverage or face a tax penalty. Our next guest is here to talk about the latest CDC findings, what's changed with the Affordable Care Act over the last couple of years, and talk about how healthcare might play a central role for presidential candidates as we head into the 2020 election. Phil Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's co-author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be back.
Well, Phil, we have these numbers from the CDC showing another year of now declines in the number of covered Americans, where that number had been going up over the years. What do you make of this latest CDC survey?
Well, I think looking at the trend from 2017 to 2018, there wasn't a statistically significant drop in the number of people who were insured. However, if you look over the sort of period from 2015 to 2018, it's a sizable number of people who have lost coverage. And when you sort of drill into the data, you realize that it's sort of not everybody is experiencing that loss in the same way. That I think a lot of what explains this loss are, so the ACA contemplated expanding health insurance coverage in a couple different ways. The first way was that people who were making up to 138% of the federal poverty level would get coverage through Medicaid. And then people who are sort of between 138% and about 400% of the federal poverty level would purchase coverage on these new private health insurance exchanges. And there, you know, importantly, the subsidies for purchasing those that coverage on those exchanges is sort of adjusted to your income. So people who are making sort of over 400% FPL don't qualify for subsidies, and it's sort of tapered up. You get more if you make less money. And what that means is that, especially for people who don't receive a substantial amount of subsidy to purchase private insurance, they're going to be really sensitive to changes in the marketplace, right? As premiums go up, or as the number of plans in their area becomes less competitive and people aren't sort of competing on price, they are going to have less of an incentive to purchase coverage. So when you look at people who are making sort of above $12,000 a year for an individual that's around 200% of the FPL, there was a statistically significant increase between 2015 and 2018 in the percentage who were uninsured. So it went up from 7.6 to 8.3%. And that's pretty telling. And I think there are a couple different things that sort of may have contributed to that. I mean, I think the first big thing is that in 2017, the individual mandate was repealed by Republicans in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And in a sense, that took away the sort of legal requirement that people buy coverage. So even if it's expensive, you know, there's this sort of legal requirement that you had to purchase it. And with that gone, there's not a lot of incentive to purchase that coverage, especially when premiums go up. And I think the other thing is that the sort of politics of the ACA has really created a level of uncertainty, which makes it undesirable for insurers to get involved in the marketplace. And I think that that the sort of politics of the ACA has also made it difficult to respond to problems as they come up. And so there's not been a lot of maintenance, in a sense, of the law.
Right. There's been talk that, okay, yes, there have been problems with the Affordable Care Act. They are fixable problems in Congress. But the debate in Congress has been, do we get rid of the Affordable Care Act, repeal it completely and replace it, or do we move to some kind of Medicare for all? There hasn't been a lot of appetite, it seems like, for the tweaks that you were just mentioning, Phil.
Well, right, and I think this week you're going to see Democrats vote on a sort of package of fixes that I think, you know, health policy folks have talked about, experts have talked about for a long time, like, you know, providing more money for states to set up their own insurance marketplaces. Like, one finding that comes out of the CDC statistics is that when states set up their own insurance marketplace, people in those states are much more likely to purchase insurance coverage on it. And that happens for a variety of reasons. States have set up their own insurance marketplaces, you know, are negotiating directly with insurers. They have better advertising campaigns. And so you see a huge differential there. And so that's sort of one thing the Democrats are pushing now. Trying to restore funding for sort of enrollment and outreach and increase reinsurance payments that sort of stabilize some of these vulnerable rural, especially marketplaces. You know, the problem, though, is I think this is actually something that, at least among Democrats, including Democrats that support Medicare for all or sort of moving to a different kind of insurance system, you know, they still support sort of making tweaks, making fixes to the ACA. But this bill, when it passes the House, as I'm sure it will, is going to be dead on arrival in the Senate. It's not going to be taken up by Mitch McConnell. And that just is that's emblematic of the broader political pattern here, which is that what actually would have to be done to sort of fix this law or at least make it work better on its own terms has just never really been in the window of political possibility.
Talking to Phil Rocco from Marquette University's Department of Political Science, co-author of the book Obamacare Wars, looking at a CDC study, a survey showing over the last few years increasing numbers of Americans without insurance, reversing a trend that had been going on for some years before that. Phil, we heard from some people on Facebook about this. Parker writes he didn't lose his health insurance, but he pays about 20% of his $40,000 salary to cover his family. That's not sustainable, Parker says. And Brandy says, it's not enough to have insurance anymore with all the costs from premiums, deductibles, and so on. You can be fully insured and still end up in the poorhouse. So even if people are covered, they may not be covered that well, or they may be paying a lot to do it, Phil.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, both of those comments really reflect the experience of health insurance for a lot of people, right? People don't live in a statistical table that shows lower levels of insurance or higher levels of insurance. People live and experience insurance primarily through what they're paying in copays, what they're paying when they go to the pharmacist counter, what their annual deductible is. And, one pattern that we've seen, if you think about what the ACA was really focused on, it's really focused on shoring up those populations of people who were not receiving insurance through their employer, say. But what we've seen among people who have employer-sponsored insurance is that every year, incrementally, there is more cost shifting from employers to employees. The number of people enrolled in high deductible health plans where they're really experiencing those high costs has sort of gradually ramped over the years. And, there's a sort of theoretical political limit to how much, employers can shift those costs onto employees without some kind of sort of reaction to the absence of affordability there.
Is that cost shifting from employers to employees something that was driven in some part by the Affordable Care Act, or is this just following a trend we've seen for years, maybe decades?
Yeah, I mean, this is arguably the trend that led to the passage of the Affordable Care Act in the first place, right? One of the things that you see if you go back sort of in the timeline is that the sort of the way that the health insurance regime in the United States was sort of set up, it was this expectation that because employers, large employers, got subsidies from the federal government to make it easier to offer insurance coverage to their employees, that would be sort of how most people got insurance. But over time, you had a few major changes, right? Number one, the cost of healthcare, you saw huge increases in medical inflation. Second, the kinds of jobs that people had sort of shifted from jobs where people had collective bargaining rights through their union to jobs that were there were sort of less negotiating power for workers. And then, the third major trend is that in the late 1970s, you started to see the greater segmentation of risk pools. So you would have insurers sort of creating or employers creating their own self-insured plans. And then these sort of broader risk pools became more expensive. And this, led to a spiral where other employers would dump their insurance coverage as well. And so that rising cost of healthcare and the increasing, unwillingness of employers to foot the bill and the lack of workers to sort of bargain, inability of workers to bargain for that, I think is the thing that really was what people cited when they were justifying why the ACA needed to be passed in the first place. But the ACA didn't really reverse any of those underlying dynamics, political dynamics or market dynamics that cause healthcare to be so expensive for employers to take on.
Phil Rocco is with us to talk about healthcare coverage and the politics thereof. A recent report from the CDC found roughly 1.1 million Americans lost health insurance coverage in 2018, a couple of years of decline now after some years of growth in coverage. Phil's an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University and co-author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the long-running, ongoing political fight over health insurance, health care, and the Affordable Care Act? What would you change? What do you want your elected officials to do when it comes to health care coverage? And what do you want to hear from candidates for Congress and the White House in 2020 when it comes to health care issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the latest CDC report that found that 1.1 million fewer Americans had health insurance coverage in 2018 and how the fight over health care is impacting people and politics. Phil Rocco is with us, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts on this latest news from the CDC, what do you want to see from political candidates when it comes to health care coverage? What's your experience? Are you uncovered now where you were covered a couple of years ago? Are you covered paying a lot? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi, thank you. I've been a sole proprietor of business for over 35 years. I've been paying my own health insurance during that time. And the ACA is the only thing that has given me affordable health care and the opportunity to live not in fear of developing a pre-existing condition. And that is a tremendous amount of stress. What I want to hear from candidates, particularly Republicans, is if they don't want the ACA, then what's their backup plan? They don't seem to have a backup plan for any of these things, and they've had well over a decade to think about it. I think the same thing goes for foreign policy, for economics, and certainly for climate change.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Phil, Tom, gives us a lot to work with there. First, as a business owner himself, he says the Affordable Care Act is the only way he can access coverage. Is that, you think, a common story?
Yeah, I think, again, you know, the ACA was a policy about, you know, looking at populations of people, including, I think, you know, increasing number of people who are sort of running their own business, aren't sort of, you know, being employed by what we think of in the sort of mid-20th century large employer model. People who are doing sort of more entrepreneurial activity and saying, you know, these folks have sort of historically lacked access to coverage. I think that that sort of small business population was a huge, huge piece of it. I think that, you know, that is a pretty broad story, you know, about the population of people whom the ACA was intended to benefit.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Phil, Tom took us into the politics of this, too. He says he didn't see a legitimate backup plan for Republicans if they did manage to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. He wasn't clear on what they were replacing it with. Do we have a sense of what Republicans would replace it with?
You know, I think that's one of the sort of trickiest areas for Republicans, which was, you know, what was their distinctive, you know, alternative to the ACA, you know, going to be? And I think what it ended up being was, looking at the sort of details of the law, was a law that was just simply less generous, provided health care to fewer people, fewer subsidies, fewer people on Medicaid, and the like. And so it wasn't as if the Republican alternatives actually solved a lot of the problems that Republicans claimed they wanted to solve, or the frustrations that people had with the ACA. In fact, when you look at what the laws, the proposed laws would have done, you know, the actual content of what they were would have caused more people to lose insurance coverage. And if you look at what the Trump administration has sort of mainly been doing, at least on the private coverage side, is they've sort of used their ability to shape regulations to allow for the sale of policies like short-term, limited-duration health insurance plans that the ACA, you know, intended it to tamp down on, which are plans that actually provide much less in terms of the benefits that people might expect. And so, you know, in a sense, the content of what the Trump administration has done is sort of repackage elements of the insurance marketplace that existed prior to the ACA, where more or less skimpier plans were being offered. They might sort of look cheaper on paper, but in terms of what you're actually paying out of pocket for your coverage, it was a lot higher. And if I could identify any alternative, it's something that looks sort of more like that, but certainly not an alternative that really responds to some of the problems that people cite when they say that they don't like their health care on the ACA, like high deductibles, something like that.
Talking to Phil Rocco from Marquette University about the Affordable Care Act and the politics of health care. Back to your calls now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hello. Yes. So it seems that our House of Representatives and our senators, having served 5 years, will get free health care for life. Now, we've also spent 18 years and roughly $13 trillion bombing unarmed women and children in the Middle East. And I think that's ridiculous that all that money could have been spent on incredible health care for every citizen and free education for every citizen in the United States. But instead, we've done an appalling job of tearing apart the Middle East and not spending a dime on the American public.
Mike, thanks for the call. So, Mike, Phil's saying if our priorities are on health care, we could afford much better.
Yeah, and I think that the in one concrete sense, healthcare has remained, you know, at the top of public concerns. When you ask people what they view as sort of one of the most important issues that is driving them to the polls, one of the things that they care about the most when they're making decisions about candidates, I mean, healthcare has remained this, top-level concern for voters. And I think one important reason that is, right, despite the fact that the ACA passed, is that when people think about how much they are spending on healthcare and, you know, even thinking about what they receive in exchange, how well they feel that they're doing, they don't feel especially, you know, like they are spending the right amount. They're spending too much for healthcare and not necessarily getting the quality of care that they demand. And so, you know, I think this is one of these issues where there is a lot of pent-up political demand that I think both at the federal and, frankly, at the state level in many states, there's just not been an especially large amount of responsiveness to.
And Phil, we just don't have too much time left, but we're seeing the idea of Medicare for All as a slogan, at least among Democratic candidates. In a minute or so, can you give us a nutshell of what practically they're talking about?
So, the major sort of Medicare for All plans, are focused on reducing the cost of care by making the federal government the single payer for care, meaning that it would be taking care of a lot of the administrative responsibilities, eliminating a lot of the duplication of labor that is involved in negotiating contracts with private insurers. And, you know, this sort of idea is sort of rather than sort of patching up the holes, people who didn't necessarily have access to insurance coverage like the ACA did, the approach of single-payer Medicare for All is to actually reconfigure the healthcare system so that a lot of the dynamics that drives people to demand more from government in terms of healthcare policy or that leads people to be unsatisfied with how expensive their care is. I mean, it's really intended to sort of reverse those longer-term dynamics that have made healthcare so unaffordable.
Phil, we'll talk to you again, and we'll have some more time to expand on that. Thanks for giving us the quick and dirty
Thanks
version
very much.
There. Thanks for
All
joining
right,
us today. I appreciate it. That's Phil Rocco, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. He's co-author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. He joined us today to talk about a new CDC survey report. It finds that 1.1 million people more were without health insurance coverage in 2018 and then the previous year. That was continuing a downward trend, reversing an upward trend over the years before that. And we looked at the role healthcare and healthcare policies could play in the 2020 elections for Congress and the White House. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll continue our series High Tolerance with a look at teens and alcohol here in Wisconsin and the latest trends and efforts to keep young people from drinking. Wisconsin is removing the word retarded from a lot of official documents. We'll find out why lawmakers and the governor have all been pushing for that change. and we've lost a lot of our privacy online. Our guest says it's time to take it back. She says consumers, businesses, and the government all need to start taking action and create a new way of doing things online. That and look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, could Wisconsin have toll roads someday? John's guest tells us how tolls work, the financial impact they can have on states, and why Congress would have to sign off before we could do it here in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, which games do you think belong in the World Video Game Hall of Fame? We'll talk about this year's finalists and inductees and let you make the case for your favorites. You can get started right now, by the way. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know about the video game that changed your life, or at least took up a big chunk of it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.